This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, April 23rd, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF comes from Westwood Gardens, offering a variety of Westwood-grown annuals, perennials, and hanging baskets. And online, a plant finder. This service matches the best-suited plants for gardens based on your input and criteria. More information available at westwoodgardens.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a series of Republican primary debates occurred over the weekend. Ruby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas speaks with blogger Jason Tolbert for an assessment. Also, a report on the approved usage of e-notarization in Arkansas.
And in the latest installment of our monthly Three People series, we speak with an editor, a reporter, and a journalism instructor about the future of newspapers and journalism. Those stories and more. But first, U.S. Senator John Bozeman is reportedly in good condition today. Arkansas's junior senator was taken to a Rogers hospital yesterday morning after experiencing arm and chest pain. According to a statement from his office, doctors ran several tests and admitted Senator Bozeman to the hospital, where he underwent heart surgery. Doctors expect the 63-year-old senator to make a full recovery.
A survey released yesterday by AARP finds that older Arkansans overwhelmingly support legislation furthering protections for older employees in the workplace. Age discrimination occurs when a person is the target of an adverse employment decision because of his or her age. According to the survey, the Protecting Older Workers Against Age Discrimination Act is supported by 81% of Arkansans older than 50 years of age. Maria Reynolds Diaz, Arkansas's AARP director, says the legislation is necessary to restore protections from age discrimination that were changed after a 2009 Supreme Court ruling.
This decision made it much harder to prove age discrimination, and it requires that older workers must prove that age was the decisive reason for their treatment rather than one reason.
Reynolds Diaz says it's important to protect the rights of older Arkansans because they often have a harder time coping with job loss.
It's catastrophic quite often when they lose their job and then they can't find a job. It takes them a while. The other thing is that we know that people just do not have a savings. Half of older workers, it's reported, have less than $25,000 in savings.
Reynolds Diaz says the survey results have been sent to Arkansas's congressional delegation, but the organization hasn't yet received comment.
Arkansas Tech University trustees yesterday announced a new president for the institution. Trustees unanimously elected Robin E. Bowen, the 12th president of the university. When she takes the post in July, she will become the first woman to serve as president of a public four-year university in Arkansas. Bowen is currently the executive vice president and provost at Fitchburg State University in Massachusetts. She will succeed Robert C. Brown, who will retire at the end of June after serving for 21 years as president of Arkansas Tech.
The Bentonville City Council last night voted to adopt certain revisions to city code regarding when developers are required to build sidewalks. Troy Galloway, Bentonville's Director of Planning and Development Services, says the old ordinance relied upon a subdivision development to trigger required sidewalk construction.
When an old house, let's say, in downtown was torn down and a new house was constructed in its place, we had nothing to trigger a sidewalk requirement in that situation, even though in every new subdivision in town where a new house was being constructed, we had the tools necessary to require that sidewalk. So in order to complete the grid of sidewalks in and around the downtown and it not necessarily be squarely on the backs of the taxpayers, when new development or redevelopment occurred, we felt that it was only fair to require in those situations where a new home was being constructed or significant alterations or additions were being made for those sidewalks to be required where they weren't previously.
Although the ordinance revisions are designed to help fill in some missing pedestrian connections in the city without costing taxpayers, Galloway says the new guidelines will affect a small percentage of development that occurs within the city on an annual basis.
When you look at the number of new housing starts that are typically affected in Bentonville on an annualized basis over the last couple of years, you're probably looking at 30 to 40 housing starts. Not a big number, but it was something that continued to grow. And again, it was just we were leaving gaps in our sidewalk system, and it didn't make sense to continue down that same path.
Galloway says under the previous ordinance, the city was missing out on as much as 2,400 linear feet of sidewalk annually when individual lots were redeveloped.
Several Northwest Arkansas schools have made passing grades in the latest ranking by U.S. News and World Reports. Five local schools were ranked within the top 1,000 in the publication's Best High Schools list. Pea Ridge High School ranked sixth in the state and was ranked at 890 in the national ranking, while Rogers Heritage High School came in five places higher at 885. Rogers High School ranked fourth in Arkansas and was listed at 837 on the national list, while Bentonville High School was ranked 580th in the nation. Topping the state ranking again was Haas Hall Academy in Fayetteville, which was ranked 137th in the nation.
A company based at the Arkansas Research and Technology Park in Fayetteville has a few million reasons to celebrate today. Arkansas Power Electronics International announced today that it has received a $3.5 million contract to develop a high-temperature power module for the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. APEI specializes in developing high-performance electronics for a variety of customers, typically used in high-temperature and high-pressure environments. According to the company, the silicon carbide power module that the company will develop for the Air Force will be incorporated into a motor drive on the F-35 that allows the pilot to control the aircraft's flight control surfaces.
A gymnast at the University of Arkansas is in the running for this year's Honda Award. The university announced yesterday that two-time national champion Katherine Grable is among the final four candidates for the award, which is given annually to the top women athletes in 12 NCAA-sanctioned sports. The All-American senior earned the first and second national titles in Arkansas gymnastic program history during the NCAA Women's Gymnastic Championship in Birmingham, Alabama on Sunday. Grable won a national title in both the vault and floor competitions.
Meanwhile, the Razorback baseball team yesterday had a successful opening to the midweek series against Northwestern State. The Razorbacks won 8-0. The series concludes today at Baum Stadium. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals also had a good day yesterday. The Nats won over the Springfield Cardinals 3-2. The series continues today at Arvest Ballpark.
Expect increasing clouds this evening with a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Overnight lows from 55 in Fayetteville to 59 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Thursday, cloudy with a 60% chance of showers with a high near 71 in northwest Arkansas. A 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high of 77 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow evening, mostly clear with lows from 42 to 50.
This is Ozarks at Large. Saturday, the Young Republicans of Arkansas hosted a series of Republican primary debates. Here are the debates that were held. For the governor's race, Curtis Coleman versus Asa Hutchinson. The candidates in the attorney general's race on the Republican side, Patricia Nation, Leslie Rutledge, and David Sterling, although Sterling was not present. In the second congressional district, Ann Clemmer, French Hill, and Colonel Conrad Reynolds shared the stage. And in the 4th District Congressional race, Tommy Maul and Bruce Westerman squared off. Also, fundraising reports for those offices and more were released recently. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently sat down for analysis with Jason Tolbert, a conservative blogger on talkbusiness.net, who knows more about GOP politics in his little pinky than most of us know in totality.
Let's talk about these debates and these races in general. Let's start first with Curtis Coleman, Asa Hutchinson, and the GOP primary. I didn't sense that there was anything that was really a game changer in that debate on Saturday.
No, I agree. It was a very lively debate. Both candidates kind of covered ground that had been covered before. Curtis Coleman has spent a lot of time talking about his business credentials, being a businessman coming from Safe Foods, and there was some discussion as to how much the state had assisted him with that. I think you did a report on that last week, and they kind of explored that a little bit further. And then, you know, Coleman kind of shot back with some of the points he had made about Asa Hutchinson supporting Eric Holder in the past for Attorney General. But they didn't really cover a lot of new ground. It was just kind of the same stuff brought up again.
So the question really, and to me, in the GOP primary is can Curtis Coleman's grassroots support, which he does have a lot of investment from just kind of Tea Party rank and file, can that overcome Asa Hutchinson's money and name ID, because he's been, you know, 3-4 decades in Arkansas politics.
Sure. And you're right. I was at the debate, almost the entire room was filled of people with Curtis Coleman for governor t-shirts on. So he had a lot of grassroots support that was actually there, that was very enthusiastic about the campaign. So he definitely has some support from those folks around the state. But if you look at fundraising, Curtis Coleman has almost no money ready to spend, ready to go, whereas Asa Hutchinson is well positioned, well over $1 million, and he should have no trouble getting his message out there on a much more widespread basis than Coleman's actually able to do.
Let's shift to the Attorney General's race. We've got three in that race: David Sterling, we've got Patricia Nation, and we've got Leslie Rutledge on the GOP side. Nate Steele's the Democrat there. The three Republicans seem to be running as far to the right as they can, trying to outflank each other one on the right. That's got to help Nate Steele in a general election lineup, doesn't it?
It could. It depends on kind of how it plays out and how that message shifts when it gets to the general election. And it's hard to really get a gauge on that. That's one where there really isn't a clear front runner. I would say that one is probably likely to go to a runoff, mm-hmm. just with three candidates in them. None of them have real strong name ID. David Sterling has picked up quite a few endorsements from some state lawmakers, from some organizations. Leslie Rutledge, I think, has slightly more fundraising than Sterling has. So it looks like probably the two of them will make it into the runoff, but it's really hard to tell. That one's kind of a wide open race.
A good coin toss there. Let's go to the second congressional district. It really had one of the best one-line zingers there that I think we'll remember from this, where there was an exchange going on between French Hill and Colonel Conrad Reynolds about some sidewalks and French Hill's support for a local tax increase when he was with the Chamber of Commerce as a leader there. And he said, "Don't get your panties in a wad, Conrad, over this."
Right. I'm glad you said that quote so I didn't have to.
But I guess the question really is, can French Hill's obviously the front runner in that race. You saw more shots fired at him than anyone else in that race. So does that race go to a runoff, do you think, or is there a strategy in a realistic way for French Hill to win that race without a runoff?
Well, I think that's really the key question. French Hill is way ahead on fundraising over the other two candidates. He's definitely going to be on the air more than the other two. He's going to have, you know, all the TV time, all the commercials for the next month. But he's got to get over that 50% threshold to avoid that runoff, and that's going to be really hard to do. Both Ann Klemmer has a large degree of support, especially out in Saline County, where she represented them in the state legislature. Conrad Reynolds has a lot of Tea Party support. I think a lot of people that support Curtis Coleman would also support Conrad Reynolds. So
he's up there in Faulkner County, which has a good regional base, too. So you've got that Saline County regional base, you've got that Faulkner County regional base, and then French Hill coming out of the most populous county in the district, Pulaski County.
Exactly right. And so what's going to be interesting is if French is not able to get that 50% mark, and it goes to a runoff, the runoff could be a much more difficult game for Mr. Hill, because Saline County is going to have a lot of runoff elections. There's 9 candidates for sheriff in Saline County. And so turnout down in really Klemmer's strength is going to be big during the June runoff. And so if Ann Klemmer can make it into a runoff with French Hill, then it's sort of a whole new ball game. So it's kind of a question is, can she keep him below that 50% mark? And that remains to be seen. How does he spend his money? Does he spend it wisely? He doesn't have a lot of name ID right now, so how much can he boost that name ID in the next month?
Yeah, it seems like he's going to be on air from now until May 20th. Yep. Okay, final race here with the congressional district in the 4th. You had Tommy Maul, Bruce Westerman. Took a few personal shots at each other, but at the same time, they are pretty much united in what they stand for in terms of their political philosophies. I don't see a lot of difference between those two candidates. Who has the advantage in the 4th Congressional District?
Well, that's another good question. That was by far the most tame debate today. Both candidates seem to agree on almost every issue. They both said one of their top priorities is repealing Obamacare, right down the list. Both of them seem to agree with almost every position that Congressman Cotton has taken. Both of them said they oppose the farm bill. In fact, Maul repeated that a couple times during the debate, really wanted to emphasize that he opposed all the food stamp funding that was in the farm bill. So I think Bruce Westerman's probably a little bit more well-known down in the 4th District, just being the House Minority Leader. Mm-hmm. He's very well-known in Garland County, which is going to pull a lot of votes in the primary. So I think right now he has an advantage. But Tom McMahon has outraced him, so he could spend the money to make up that difference.
And I thought Westerman got a good dig in there, too, with Tommy Maul talking about him voting in a Democratic primary back in 2006, but not voting in the general, which could have helped Asa Hutchinson, is what Westerman
said. And Tommy Maul did not handle that one well. He responded, well, I don't really follow my votes very closely, or something along that nature. And that was not a very good response. That was by far Westerman's best moment of the debate.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas, speaking with blogger Jason Tolbert. For more, visit talkbusiness.net. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T. Challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. We've got some new acoustic Luther Dickinson. Also, Francine Reed, Cephas and Wiggins, The Insomniacs, Elvin Bishop, Roscoe Gordon, and more. Again, that's the Generic Blue Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock on KUAF. We'll see you then.
As journalism continues to change, are there things that journalists are concerned about for the future of their field?
What I don't want to see disappear is some kind of delivery mechanism for news that creates a common base of knowledge within a community. Right now, newspaper shows up on your driveway, on your doorstep, and you're opening up a newspaper, and it's the same news delivered to everybody who subscribes to that newspaper. There's some value to me in everybody within a community.
Shared experience.
Shared experience.
Yes.
And you can define community in a whole bunch of different ways. I live in Fayetteville, Fayetteville is community to me, and I want all the people in Fayetteville to have some kind of a source that is a common source of information, not their only source, but that we can have a shared knowledge base.
That story is coming up in the second half hour of Ozarks at Large.
Most of us must seek out the services of a notary public to affix their stamp onto our important documents after we sign them. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, Arkansas Secretary of State, which holds notary oversight, has approved the use of e-notarization.
A notary public acts as an official and unbiased witness to the identity of an individual who, for example, is giving a written testimony or signing a legal document. Danielle Fosco is a special projects coordinator for the Business and Commercial Services Division for the Arkansas Secretary of State, which regulates the state's notaries.
We have about 60,000 commissioned notaries in Arkansas currently for all sorts of documents, mortgage documents, some school documents. I competed in the Miss Arkansas pageant system, and even my applications for that system, those had to be notarized as well. So there's multiple documents where, verification is key and identity is key on these important documents.
And up until this month, notary transactions were strictly done on paper.
Someone will find a notary. They come to you in person with their hard copy printed documents. They take a simple pen. They sign their name. The notary verifies identity through a driver's license, some other form of photo identification. The notary then signs that document as well with pen and then stamps it with a rubber stamp. It's just very, very simple.
On April 2nd, Arkansas Secretary of State Mark Martin announced that Arkansas would be implementing electronic notarization of documents. E-notarization involves affixing an electronic digital signature and notary seal to notarize digital documents validated with a digital certificate.
It's the Secretary's initiative. He's the one who brought this to us about a year ago and said, this is what I want to do. It is the year 2014, and technology has changed. Times have changed. As I mentioned before, verification is key in protecting identities, especially with identity theft on the rise. And e-notary has more protections in place. It uses what's called public key infrastructure, which uses complex mathematical algorithms and hashing. It essentially encrypts documents. So we now have the ability to encrypt documents, further preventing fraud, as well as eliminating paper from the transaction as a whole. You know, many things nowadays are done electronically, submitted electronically, and this takes paper out of the equation completely if the parties so choose.
Busco says that e-notarization is a varied process.
The client could come to a notary with a hard copy of a document. In that case, the notary would scan the document into a system, probably creating a PDF. It would make the document electronic. The e-notary would then log into a web portal. All this is done through a web portal. It would log in with an identifying name of some sort as well as a password. So they've got their first step for the notary to prove they are who they are by logging into the system, the secure system. The notary would then go in and have to follow, it's kind of a wizard, of steps to, you know, verify the identity of the signer. In that case, some of these portals even require the notary to enter specific information about the signer's identification, such as what's the name printed on it, maybe the last four digits of a driver's license. So we've got a step that's further proving that the person's appearing before the notary.
The notary's electronic digital signature would be pre-created or entered by keyboard, Fusco says, and the customer would also enter their signature through a keyboard or signature pad, whichever is available.
And would then go digitally onto that document. The notary would then enter their signature once again, either through a keyboard or through a signature pad, and it would then appear on that document electronically. And the notary's seal of office, which would require all of the same information as the rubber stamp, it would be a digital image that would be dragged and dropped onto that document. And you would then save the document from there, and you can either print it off, secure it, or save it in a secure vault type system. You can email the document. But once those signatures are placed on that document and that digital seal is placed on there, those have certain forms of encryption with them to where if anything is modified after it's signed, even removing a period from the document, doing anything to it, would then flag that document as being tampered with or possibly forged. So you could then submit it electronically. The other step, same steps. Say someone brings you a document on a flash drive, you would just upload it into your computer and do those same steps from there. Or the client can email the document to the notary. But like with a regular notary, the client still has to appear personally before the notary in their presence.
E-notarization standards were first approved by the National Association of Secretaries of State in 2006, then offered to states for voluntary adoption. The standards require that electronic signature is unique to the notary, capable of independent authentication, retained under the notary's sole control and attached to or logically associated with the electronic document. At least 18 states have adopted e-notarization. Personal appearance before the notary is still required in Arkansas, although Virginia is the first state to authorize remotely witnessed e-notarization utilizing web-based audiovisual technology. And any Arkansas notary public in good standing is eligible to apply to become an e-notary.
You can go to our website, which is sos.arkansas.gov. You would then go to the Business and Commercial Services link and find the electronic notary link. And on there, there is an application. You submit that application to us along with a $20 fee. We'll process it, and you can then sign up for our mandatory training. There is a mandatory training for this because there is so much technology involved, and it is so secure. We do have mandatory training and a short exam at the end. Once you've done that, you can then go sign up with a solution provider of your choice. We have two approved solution providers so far. They are Doc Verify and Worldwide Notary, and they have two different types of systems that they use. So it depends on the e-notaries, what they want to use, if they want to use a web portal or go with that signature pad. It's a very simple process, and your e-notary commission lasts throughout your traditional commission.
A notary can charge up to $5 per paper or electronic document. E-notaries will also incur a small surcharge for each electronic transaction or pay a monthly fee to their e-notary vendor.
Our companies up here in Mountain Home, where I'm currently sitting, actually contacted us and said, when this goes live, we will save $800 a month on printing costs alone. So the little bit extra fee that it costs to be an e-notary pays off in the long run when you're saving on those paper and printing costs.
As well as trees. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Wednesday, April 23rd, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know, I love that theme thing.
I do.
And Wednesday seems to be wacky.
Okay.
I like it. This is a great wacky.
Okay.
It's something like Shakespeare, but it's also something like Monty Python.
Okay.
Or so says Blaine Swin, who is the creator and director of the Chicago-based Improvised Shakespeare Company, who will be in town tonight at the Walton Arts Center.
Tell me how this works, because I keep hearing about it.
Okay, he says that the show opens with the audience given an opportunity to call out the title of a play.
Shakespeare play.
No.
Any play.
A play. He said they've gotten Rocky Hamlet Picture Show.
So you can make up your own.
Right.
Play.
They've gotten Midsummer Night's Menopause.
Okay.
Or they once had to do a play just called Justin Bieber.
I like it.
But he says it wasn't too bad. He ended up being killed in the end by the Jonas Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So once they have the title, then they try to do the show with Shakespearean
flair,
English and Shakespearean references. So you don't say cell phone. You don't say Facebook. Facebook is a wooden post somewhere around town where people can carve messages or poke the board.
Okay.
And a car is a carriage. This guy has a PhD.
In?
I think philosophy.
Okay.
Something ridiculous. But he ended up doing Shakespeare as short form comedy. And then it grew up to be this. And they've been in business for 8 or 10 years now. So it goes over well. He says, every time we perform, the show is fresh and new and different. It is the only time it will be performed.
Right.
Which is cool.
So there's only one play each performance?
Yes.
Okay.
As I understand it.
Okay.
We'll find out at 7:30 tonight. It's only $10. It's part of the 10 by 10 series at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. And he says, the audience should try to trip us up with a strange suggestion. There's no such thing as a bad title. We accept the challenge.
So start thinking.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
When Amy Webb turned 30, she decided to find her true love on an online dating site. And to do it right, she hacked the algorithm to find the perfect man.
And as it turns out, I was the most popular person online.
Stories of how we love. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Listen Sunday at noon to 91.3 FM.
The longtime director and founder of the Myeloma Institute for Research and Therapy at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences is stepping down. Yesterday, he was honored for his work and a successor was announced. Keisha Nanda from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock has this report.
Dr. Gareth Morgan, who is currently a clinician and researcher with the Institute of Cancer Research in London, was named to the position. He was welcomed to Little Rock by Governor Mike Beebe.
Dr. Morgan, you are our new friend, and you are our new colleague and citizen of the state of Arkansas, and we welcome you with open arms.
Dr. Morgan said he's excited to lead UAMS's Myeloma Institute beginning in July.
But most of all, I think it's an opportunity for patients. You know, we're curing people now. Their task is to cure more patients. And what I think I can bring to the party is new tools that we can bolt onto what the infrastructure that BART has set up to really take us to that next level where the percentage of cured patients is more.
Morgan is replacing Dr. Bart Barlogi, who founded the center nearly 25 years ago to research and treat multiple myeloma, a rare form of bone marrow cancer. Although Dr. Barlogi is retiring as director, he says he will continue working in the clinical care.
I'm committed to be there with Gareth to give my full support to whatever endeavors he's going to pursue.
A myeloma patient, who is also a physician, Dr. Mary Pinizotto, was treated by Barlogi.
I knew the instant I met Dr. Barlogi that this is where I would get my treatment. The passion and the compassion and his desire to cure this disease was all I needed to see to know that I had made the right decision. And as you can see, I'm 6 years out now.
UAMS Chancellor Dr. Dan Ron says the Institute treats more myeloma patients than any other such cancer center in the world. As a result, he says it brings many people to Little Rock each day.
There are about 300 individuals with this disease, with various members of their family, who are staying in Little Rock for diagnosis and treatment at the Myeloma Institute.
UAMS also announced the Myeloma Institute has received about $20 million in state funding and philanthropic contributions. In Little Rock, I'm Keisha Nanda.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. American poet Billy Collins has been named the editor of the Miller Williams Poetry Series, which is published by the University of Arkansas Press. As editor, Collins will be ultimately responsible for the books published through the series and for choosing the winner of the annual Miller Williams Poetry Prize. The University of Arkansas Press accepts submissions of manuscripts for the prize year-round. As many as four of those manuscripts, the winner and up to three finalists, are selected for publication. The winner receives $5,000 in cash in addition to publication.
The Gamma chapter of Gamma Eta Sorority Incorporated is hosting a domestic violence prevention program at 7 p.m. on the U of A campus in room 507 in the Arkansas Union. Rose Stanton, the outreach director of the Northwest Arkansas Women's Shelter, will be speaking at the event.
The 12th annual Northwest Arkansas Take Back the Night March is scheduled for tomorrow evening. Respect, Rape Education Services by Peer Encouraging Conscious Thought, a peer education program on the University of Arkansas campus, is inviting the community to attend the event and speak out against sexual violence and sexual abuse. Participants will gather at 6:45 at Arves Plaza on the downtown square. Following opening remarks, the participants will march to Old Main. Closing activities will include a candlelight vigil, inspirational singing, and more. Commemorative glow-in-the-dark t-shirts are available for $10 at the Pat Walker Health Center. Proceeds benefit campus rape awareness and prevention education. For more, search Respect University of Arkansas on Facebook.
The Northwest Arkansas Workers' Justice Center is hosting the third annual Cesar Chavez Commemoration Dinner, May 2nd, at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. Activist, attorney, author, teacher speaker, and consultant Monica Ramirez is the keynote speaker. After graduating from law school, she founded the first legal project in the United States dedicated to preventing, remedying, and ending sexual harassment and other forms of gender discrimination against farm worker women in Florida. Admission is $25 for an individual and $15 for students and worker members. A table of eight may be reserved for $175. Guests should RSVP by April 26th. That's this Saturday. For more, email anna.wjc@gmail.com or call 750-8015.
This is Ozarks at Large. Your newspaper has changed in the last 20 years. Physically, many papers are smaller than they used to be, and several have fewer sections. You may not even read a newspaper made of paper, but one on a screen. Some notable papers, like the New Orleans Times-Picayune, have ceased to be printed on paper every day of the week. Recently, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums asked three journalists with experience in the Northwest Arkansas newspaper industry to come in for a conversation about the future of newspapers and journalism for this month's installment of our Three People series. Greg Harton is the opinion page editor for Northwest Arkansas Media, and before that, he spent several years as a reporter. John Gore is the city reporter for the Rogers Morning News, and he has been a reporter in several other states before moving here. Steve Wilkes is the director of student media at the University of Arkansas, and he oversees, among other things, the publication of the student newspaper, The Arkansas Traveler, a paper he edited when he was a student at the U of A. Each of the three began their careers when the arrival of the paper on the doorstep was a given. Daily occurrence in the newspaper was one of the, if not the, main sources of information. Here are excerpts from their conversation, including a discussion about another change, the shifting of deadlines because of instant information sources like Twitter. We'll hear from Greg Harton first.
In the grand scheme of things, the deadlines are every day, every moment, it's as soon as something is completed, as an event is completed, there's a push to get the information out there. Or an expectation, I guess. It depends on the event sometimes as to whether there's that immediacy in our situation.
In fact, we, at the last meeting of the Lake Atlanta situation, mm-hmm. I tweeted live from the city council as to what was going on, who was speaking, and what the vote was. So it went out within seconds after it was taken.
And that's something you're teaching now, right?
Absolutely. There's courses in social media. Ray Miner's teaching a course in that. I don't know who else is doing that. And, of course, we're working hard to learn how to be journalists in this world. And the students, of course, it's interesting because, of course, they've kind of grown up with this stuff, as it's happened. And a year or two ago, we had a sports guy that was great. He would go to the games, baseball game, he would tweet the game live. It was like play-by-play. And I got to where I followed, Arkansas sports on Twitter because he was so good at it. So it's really interesting. But then the downside, of course, is that you'll get a journalist who tweets too quickly and doesn't know the story and either gets some portion of it wrong, and perhaps it's enough that it's really a problem. And that's happened as well.
John and Greg, what kind of conversations, because Twitter's been with us now for several years.
I think they just turned eight,
yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm. What kind of conversations have taken place in the newsroom about Twitter and about the need for your entity to be out there tweeting as well, getting it fast?
Well, at first it was viewed as kind of a reporter's option. If you wanted to do it, we weren't going to make you do it. Increasingly, it's become more of an expectation, not for every single event, but for those events where we know the reader interest is high and, like the John's city council meeting, where people are watching for that. Usually they really appreciate seeing those quick hits. You know, interestingly, like at the Fayetteville City Council, I think it's Don Maher who sits there and tweets out directly from the city administration perspective what's happening, and he does a pretty good job of just, you know, reporting here's what they voted on, here's what the issue is. And so, you know, it's not just media. It's more direct for politicians, for city officials, county officials. It's a direct link to their constituents out there. And so I think journalists have to look at it from a perspective of what are we doing differently? The tweets are going to be tweets in terms of the immediate, but then what are we going on to do with it in terms of the full story that gives the reader something more complete?
So the competition now is not just a newspaper v. newspaper or newspaper and television. It's a city administrator. It could be the Fayetteville Flyer blog. It could be anybody who's in the audience. I mean, does that seem like competition to you?
To an extent. I've always been an advocate for people getting their information from a variety of sources. So competition, to me, is a good thing. I liked it. You know, when we had multiple newspapers and multiple outlets and all, I think most journalists enjoyed that competition.
Absolutely.
Yes, we view it as some competition, not so much just the average Joe sitting in the audience, because most of the time that person is there for a specific issue, and they haven't built an audience up of city residents and all that are going to be, you know, involved on an ongoing basis with that person necessarily. So, but the city administration, some of the politicians, the various news media, I mean, you can have tweets coming from multiple sources, and that's a good thing. I think John's right that, you know, the context and some of the history there and all, you've got to go beyond the tweets for that in a lot of instances. But I can appreciate that when you're at an event, you know, you are competing to try to grab people's attention and help them to understand that this is an event that is worth paying attention to.
Greg, John, you are in newspapers. Steve, your background is a newspaper. You were a traveler editor. Mm-hmm. Newspaper's going to survive?
Yes, they're going to survive. They're not going to look the same, I don't think, in 50 or 20 years. I'm not yet at the place where, what's the guy that owns Amazon? Bezos, is that his name?
Jeff Bezos. Yeah.
I'm not at the place where he says it'll be like horses. You know, we still have horses, but they're not our primary mode of transportation. Print will not be that, I hope. But the truth of the matter is people are spending much more time on particularly mobile devices, whether it's a phone or a tablet. You know, they say that the desktop was going to kill print so many years ago, and of course it didn't. But if anything is going to kill print, I think it's going to be a mobile device, a tablet-sized device. It might not look like these tablets that we have today, but Sony and other corporations and universities are working on flexible computers, flexible digital things that can download as a, you know, content from a satellite and change the page, you know, as you move along. So you're driving down the highway, and you're driving, say, from Fayetteville to Amarillo, and when you pass through different market areas, your newspaper will literally change. Mm. That technology is going to come, whether it comes in our professional lifetimes or lifetimes, I don't know, but that's going to come. And so I really think it's really the idea of telling the story. It's really the idea of being a reporter and telling the story and then getting that story into the hands of the citizenry. That's what, to me, is important. And so whether that's on newsprint or it's in a mobile device like an iPad or wherever that is, I don't think that changes the fundamental purpose of a newspaper. And I don't know that we'll still call them newspapers, but that's my take on it.
The information source will still be there.
Yeah.
You ask, will newspapers die? Yes. The question is when. And I think they've got a long way to go before they die. But that's just talking about the physical delivery device. It's not talking about what journalists do. What I don't want to see disappear is some kind of delivery mechanism for news that creates a common base of knowledge within a community. Right now, newspaper shows up on your driveway, on your doorstep, and you're opening up a newspaper, and it's the same news delivered to everybody who subscribes to that newspaper. There's some value to me in everybody within a community.
Shared experience.
Shared experience. And you can define community in a whole bunch of different ways. I live in Fayetteville, so Fayetteville is community to me, and I want all the people in Fayetteville to have some kind of a source that is a common source of information, not their only source, but that we can have a shared knowledge base. Because once that falls apart, then you have to start wondering about the impacts on how we govern. How we even come to consensus in a community if we have no common knowledge base.
My concern is the one thing newspapers do real well is they have reporters on the ground. I cover the city of government of Lowell and Rogers. I also do other things within the city of Rogers. We have an education reporter. We have a police reporter. We have an enterprise reporter. But they're on the ground. They know their beat. They know the people. They know what the issues are. If you lose that, where are bloggers going to get their information? Where is television going to get its information? Where are the bottom line? Where are the people going to get their information about things that affect their daily life? Because a municipal government has more impact on your life than the federal government, in my opinion.
Okay, so you have a beat. And there used to be a time when newspapers had larger staffs, there were so many beats. There are still beats. John, fair to say, all modesty aside, that you probably know more about Rogers City government than just a handful of people.
Absolutely.
I mean, maybe Mayor Hines and a few others, but because that's what you're supposed to do, right?
I go there every day. I talk to everybody in City Hall every day. I know what's going on in the city of Rogers.
And you got to have that if you're going to have that common source. You've got to have people who have beats, who know what to ask, when to ask, and what to look for, right?
You absolutely have to do that. And on a local scale, it is one of those questions of who is going to do it if there's not a news organization committed to doing that.
That's it.
You can't. You know, we talked earlier about city administration's tweeting. Well, as well-intentioned as they may be, they have a perspective where, you know, they have certain agenda that they want to achieve.
Just like an athletic department or an entertainment venue?
Yes. And, you know, the University of Arkansas, right, in terms of athletics, you know, they have their own media operation, their own website that people pay for to get news and video and all that from the Razorbacks. But will that organization cover a Bobby Petrino type of scenario?
If left to only their devices,
absolutely will not get that from them. And some Razorback fans are just fine with that, you know, as long as it helps the program. But when you are, whether it's the university, the city of Fayetteville, whenever public tax dollars are involved, you need outside news coverage. It's helpful.
When I was growing up, you had the 5:30 news from one of three networks. You had the morning paper. Where I grew up, it was a statewide paper that was, you know, nothing after 6 p.m. got into the Democrat or the Gazette at that point. But what you had was this, not just a common shared, but this omnibus of things. So, like, before I would get to the story about the Rogers City Council, I might first see a story about the state legislature or something that I wouldn't have known. Now there are so many sources that if all I wanted to know about was Razorback sports, I could go to that Razorback website. I could go to any number of sports websites and pick your topic. Yeah. But you can easily now pigeonhole and not be informed. And I mean, that's up to the individual's responsibility, I guess. But I don't know. I just miss those times when you had to kind of at least see the picture on the front page about what might be happening in Syria.
We had a story the other day about service organizations like Rotary, Kiwanis, those sorts of things.
It's
and
a good story.
How they were struggling and are struggling with younger generations feeling that commitment to community to join a service organization and do volunteer work and those sorts of things. Are we teaching kids today about their civic nature, their civic responsibilities? And I don't know if they feel the same way as older generations do about that. But ultimately, you can't complain about the abundance of information.
No.
The free flow of information is a great thing. It's really what we do with it. And that's larger than, will newspapers survive and all of that. It's
right.
It's how are we going to be as a nation, as a people, and how are we going to govern ourselves? And if we have people that really pigeonhole themselves into, you know, I'm just interested in kayaking.
Or this right. ideology.
Or an ideology. Then I think that's a dangerous thing.
Kind of becoming a nation of savants.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
You know, which is just insane. But it's, you know, I think that's happening, unfortunately. And I would like to see, to go back to what Greg mentioned, I would like to see better civics taught in middle school and junior high school, even college. I can't comment on what any school district in particular is doing, but I just see so much evidence of college-aged folks who just really don't know what a newspaper is. They don't know how to read it. They don't get it that the opinion page is opinion, but the front page is not, and they don't understand that difference necessarily. I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but I see it all the time. And I think that it's going to be even more important as we lose this common field of a printed newspaper, as that begins to go away, that we somehow get to the heart of how are you a good citizen in your town or in your country or in your state? And part of that is knowing the news, knowing what's going on. And it makes me crazy when people don't know what's going on.
Steve Wilkes is the director of student media at the University of Arkansas. We also heard from John Gore, city reporter for the Rogers Morning News, and Greg Harton, the opinion page editor of Northwest Arkansas Media. They talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums for our monthly Three People series. If you have a suggestion for a topic you'd like to hear covered in this series, send us an email at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, President Obama goes to Asia after several canceled trips. What sort of reception will he get in Japan, especially given increasing tensions with China?
I think Japanese are really glad that he's coming, and they are looking to President Obama for reassurance.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF.
KUAF is proud to co-sponsor the 2014 Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure. The 5 and 10K race, plus 1 mile family walk, will take place April 26th at the Pinnacle Hills Promenade in Rogers. A pre-race pasta party will be held Friday, April 25th. Registration, pasta tickets, and more available at KomenOzark.org or by calling 750-PINK.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart AMP. Presenting Steve Martin, The Steep, Canyon Rangers, and Edie Brickell August 3rd. This concert will highlight Steve Martin's blend of comedy and bluegrass, and the band will introduce new tracks from their recent live album. Tickets and information available at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
A listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Crosses.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
We'll end today's show with some music by the Randy Rogers Band. They'll be performing tonight at 9 at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville. You can find out more information at randyrogersband.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.
All the leaves have turned rust, and the air's getting thin. I can see my breath, the night is rolling.